This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Alexander Julian's designs have graced runways and the pages of fashion magazines for decades. He's known internationally for creating his own clothing fabric and for Colors by Alexander Julian, a clothing line that many say changed how American men dress. He won accolades, including 5 prestigious Coty Awards, and he is an inductee in the Fashion Hall of Fame. In North Carolina, of course, he's best known for his signature Carolina Blue Argyle and for redesigning the Tar Heel sports uniforms. But before he was a famed designer, he was Alex, a mischievous kid growing up in Chapel Hill, picking up fashion cues at his father's clothing store, Maurice Julian's Haberdashery on Franklin Street. Alexander Julian joins us now on the State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you
here. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina.
You are certainly responsible for, I mean, obviously you brought us the championships, though I should say.
Well, no, the team did all that work. I gilded the lily.
Because I was going to ask you, you also designed the Charlotte Hornets.
Yes, I did. I'm one of the few people in college sports to have to make it in the pros first.
Well, kind of, except that you were successful in bringing a championship to Carolina, not so much for Charlotte. What do you think is wrong with the design of the Charlotte uniform that didn't bring them a championship?
No.
Let's go back to your childhood. I want to hear about growing up here in Chapel Hill.
Still haven't grown up.
Or whatever it is you did. Tell us about your parents, Maurice and Mary.
I had the luck of the draw of being born to two wonderful folks in Chapel Hill, and because my father was came from New England down to Chapel Hill in the 30s to go to school. He was UNC class of 38. My mother from a old Tar Heel family, 1728, I think, from Scotland, but. The Julian's College Shop, as it was known when my sister and I were born into it. You know, the rumors that I was born in the custom department of my father's store are not true, but it is true, and I'm not kidding. I had blue Oxford cloth diapers, and I had little tiny Basswegians, and you know, I was just the average kid that at 5 years old had custom made suits.
But tell us more about those Basswegians and the blue Oxford, because you know that is a design that you know children of the 80s would know as preppy.
Well, the New York Times last year described my parents as the godparents of preppy, and I think if you look back historically, this is my premise.
Yeah,
Carolina. Oldest state-owned university in America, incredible institution, but not Ivy League. Location, location, right. Location. Right. My father comes down from New England, from Massachusetts, understands all the trappings of Ivy League, ends up opening the Julian's in 1942, and it's sort of Ivy League style meets Southern love of color and exuberance, a.k.a. my mother, and begets preppy. And, you know, because both my parents worked, that store was my playground. I guarantee you I knew more about fabrics when I was 10 years old than I do now.
What about your father's initiation into this business? I mean, was this something that he had sort of loved his whole life, or how did he come into it?
You know, I think it's something he wanted to do. He admired some great retailers in specialty stores in New England, but he grew up in a very, very poor immigrant family. My paternal grandparents came from Russia in 1902. Dad was born in 15 in Massachusetts. He had to work his way through grade school, through high school, through college, and I suspect that it started because Brockton, Massachusetts, his birthplace, was the shoe capital of America. And I think he started bringing, trunkloads of shoes back from visiting home.
Sold those, and it kind of worked. I wonder, was there any – obviously, it caught on pretty quickly, the styles. Did he ever talk about – you know, sort of any kind of culture clash between the North and the South, and whether or not it was difficult to bring those styles of the Basswegians at all?
No. You know, he was a pioneer. I was in and around the store, as I said. I lived there after school. I lived there before school, and he had some health issues, and I started working in the store. He kind of was trying to live vicariously through my sister Missy and I, forbidding us to work because he never had a childhood where he didn't have to work, and he wanted us to do that. And, you know, I think the reverse psychology inadvertently succeeded, where I can't wait to get to work.
In that business, when did you develop the eye for fashion?
Oh, who knows? My mother claims that I, you know, this is, I mean, this is, I, you always trust your mother, but my mother always claimed that I knew the difference between hundreds, two-ply cotton, and 50 singles when I was 5 years old. I designed my first shirt after a pickup football game and a fight that ensued and tearing the collar and going to put a yellow collar at Dad's tailor on a blue shirt. And I remember our tailor saying, you know, you ain't going to like this. And, you know, I wore it to school the next week when it was washed, and I think it was Linda Holloway or Cheryl Jernigan, but one of the best looking girls in school suddenly turned to me and started a conversation. And man, I've been hooked on fashion ever since.
It worked. And your uncle was also in the business, right?
Yes. My father's youngest brother started out when he came down to Carolina working for Dad, and then did his own store across the street.
Now, his own store across the street in a little town like Chapel Hill?
Well, there were seven major men's stores on one block of Franklin Street in the 50s and the 60s.
Did they get along? I mean, was there tension there?
It had been an unhappy parting of ways.
I see.
And I'm sure each side of the family has their own version of it, but they didn't speak for 20 years, and thank goodness they reconciled and ended up having lunch together at the Ratskeller in Chapel Hill every day for the last 20 years of their lives.
You know, this brings us to an interesting question.
My father's life.
Taking us back to your sort of this collar that you, the shirt that you designed after the collar was torn off. And that's the difference between a kind of a creative eye, this is going to work, and also, but working in a retail establishment, a store like that, you also find out what already works, right? You see
sells. That is key. And, you know, the first time I went to design school was to teach. My school of fashion was my parents' store. And, you know, part of my genesis was at a very early age, realizing that there was a common denominator in every retail store that sold any kind of apparel, and that's cloth. And to me, when I went to do my first collection, you know, to me, the first thing to do is you design the fabric. But I didn't know what not to do. It's not taught that way in schools to start out that way. And that's really ended up being where I made my biggest impact.
So, I want to get again this fuller picture of Chapel Hill at the time you were growing up. You were friends with a guy named James Taylor.
Well, we grew up together.
Yeah,
Carol Kaiser, you know, Kay Kaiser and Georgia Carroll's daughter was in our class. Bland Simpson, the great writer and singer. It was a small group of great kids, and you know, it was a university town. The majority of the kids that we grew up with were sons and daughters of professors and students, and certainly not all. But it was a great mix of kids. And I remember, I think it was fourth grade, a professor from Heidelberg came to Chapel Hill with his two kids. They taught the two kids English, and they taught the whole school German. And you know, back in the 50s, that foreign languages were not taught in grammar school. We were part of sort of a experimental thing. We got to read. There was no fixed rate. You could read all the way up to past college level in fifth grade if you could do it.
Yeah. The idea that kids' minds develop on different scales at different timetables.
Yeah. I mean, it's common knowledge now, but we were sort of guinea pigs.
It is. And again, very creative individuals all thrown together who go on to have their separate careers. James Taylor and Bland Simpson, of course, in music, you in design. Now, when you decided to share your musical talents on stage with James Taylor, we find out that not all creativity is alike.
You're talking about the last time I sang in public. I think I was nine. We were part of the Junior Playmakers, James and I, Bland, Carol Kaiser, whose mother was a major, major important singer and a gorgeous, one of the most beautiful women on the planet. And at the first rehearsal, there was a song, and at the first rehearsal, she was the voice coach, and she took me aside, and she says, "Alec, honey, I got a special favor to ask you. I'd like you to just mouth the words." And I thought, well, sure, Mrs. Kaiser. I haven't sang in public since.
You politely decided not to comment on her wardrobe, which I applaud you for.
She was always well-dressed.
Alexander Julian is my guest. We're going to find out more of his story on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with legendary fashion designer Alexander Julian, inducted into the Fashion Hall of Fame when he was just 33 years ago. He's created countless lines of fashion, furniture, and even perfume. In North Carolina, of course, famous for redesigning the Tar Heel sports uniforms with his signature blue argyle. So before we get you there, we got to get you out of Chapel Hill. You talked about, you know.
You can never get me out of Chapel Hill.
You're welcome back. You were doing okay. I mean, you talked about this kind of creative upbringing, an interesting place to grow up, but then school got a little boring for you.
Well, no, school was never really boring to me. The problem, as I grew into adolescence, my father and I, he had a very strong personality. And I was, we clashed quite a bit. And, you know, in my early teens, and my mother thought it best to get thyself away and sent me to the Bowles School in Jacksonville, Florida, which had been military, was not. It was unfortunately before it was co-ed, or else I'd probably still be there. But I, you know, it was a very good prep school, and they taught everything a year ahead of what the public schools did, because they ended up, like most prep schools, giving you first year college, your senior year of high school, so that you're, you know, feel comfortable making the transition. I didn't make it there that long, but what my parents didn't realize was, if you had an AB average and an invitation from someone's kind parent, you could go off campus every weekend. And I had the AB average and a friendly parent, and had set it up at 15 years old, where I had I had it wired. I had it set up to do basically live as if I was a junior in college. And I won't go into the details.
That's not even healthy for a junior in college.
No, I
take your point.
My mother realized that. And so 10th grade was my only year away. Came back to Chapel Hill, which, you know, in hindsight, was a bit of a problem, because I had always been an eager learner and loved science, math, you know, wanted to be a combination geologist, archaeologist, chemist, all this stuff as a kid. And here I find myself in 11th grade at Chapel Hill High School, taking the same courses I had made A's and B's in the previous year, on a tougher curricula at the prep school. So,
and you'd also tasted what is euphemistically called a lot of freedom. And you know, obviously you'd been out there drinking and doing that kind of stuff. Did that carry over?
I had girlfriends and all the stuff going on. And well, you know, how are you going to get them back on the farm?
Right.
You know, and so that caused further clashes. It also caused me to miss a lot of school that year. We had a school skipping contest, and our little clique, and I was the winner. 43 half days and 29 full days. Wow. That was the legal limit to not be held back. And then took the college boards, probably because it was my first time to take them as a junior in high school, and I didn't worry about it. And the next thing I know, UNC asked if I wanted to skip my senior year of high school and come a year early, where I was you know, here I'd been at a prep school where I had great freedom. Then I come back home where I had no freedom, except during the day when I was truant. Yeah. And then the next year, I'm a freshman at UNC. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember them asking for my I had to write down a major. And my father, who grew up in the Depression, poor, had always said, you know, you need to be a doctor or a lawyer. So I signed up pre-med for my first major at Carolina. But I said to my father, Pop, you know, I'll fulfill your wishes. I'll do that. But you have to allow me a little freedom here. You need to be okay with me being a psychiatrist. And he said, son, I had no idea you liked psychiatry. I said, well, I really don't know anything about it. I just don't want to wear white. And that's a true story.
Seriously, so fashion is on your mind. Well, had you thought about fashion as a career at that point?
Not in the very least. Yeah. Not in the very least. Dad had a series of heart attacks. I was thrust back into the store, working in the store, buying for the store. And all of a sudden, the same cranium that used to love chemistry formulas and mathematical equations, I mean, it my brain flipped, and I could think about was a particular fabric design, or, you know, what if this fabric looked like that, or that fabric looked like this, and I felt this sort of movement happening in the American menswear scene, where to me it was as clear as the handwriting on the wall that what we used to know traditionally as what we used to know as American traditional menswear and European menswear, that was the dividing line between the two schools of stores that would provide apparel for men.
What time? Where are we in?
In the 60s.
Yeah. Okay.
This is the mid 60s, and I kept trying. I mean, I kept buying, you know, what you would call hipper and hipper things for my father's store, for Julian's. But it, you know, it was kind of a misfit to me to have those things in that environment with all the tradition and all the traditional clothes. And I was looking for a new kind of tradition. And Dad had a little real estate in town, and I kept trying to convince him that what we should do is open a branch under another name across the street and go after this, you know, younger, hipper customer, and he would never commit. He kept hemming and hawing, and he always had an excuse. And look, son, well, you know, we'll talk about that. I was 21. I decided to sort of grab the bull by the horns, and I had it all set up. And when he and my mother and my dear sister Missy went off for summer vacation for a month, you know, they were barely through Durham by the time I let a tenant out of a 5-year lease, and I basically opened another store without my father's knowledge when he was out of town.
Across the street.
Across the street, yeah. So you called Alexander's Ambition. I still have the sign in the back of Julian's now.
And just to go back a step, you say you had it all set up. I mean, you really were able to get things going very quickly.
We opened in less than a month.
So what all did you
spend doing? And spent today's equivalent of probably, you know, $500,000 of my father's money. And I hope none of my kids are listening to this and think that this gives them permission, because it doesn't.
Well, you didn't have permission. Let's go through this.
You, yeah, two wrongs don't make a right. Two wrongs don't
property,
make a right.
Let somebody out of a lease that you're
the guy was going to go bust. It was a jewelry store, and he was going to go bust, and we would have been stuck with it anyway. So it wasn't as terrible as it sounded. And
not exactly your father's decision, however.
Well, no, it was – I was disinherited for 3 days that time.
This is the point I want to make.
That was the longest.
$500,000 of your father's dollars, and you open a shop across the street from your father's store.
But he owned it, and he ultimately benefited from it.
Yeah. However, but how did that go?
However, it was mega importance in later – life for as a step in my career for what I learned doing that. However, my only regret was it was just disastrous between my father and I. And it was, you know, it was ego versus ego. Mm-hmm. And he took it personally. He even though he owned it and would benefit from any sale, he thought I was the worst competitor. And maybe it was a sort of reflection of how he felt about his brother opening a store across the street, you know, back in the 40s. I don't know, but it was nasty.
But let me ask you about, because there are reports. I mean, people will talk about seeing the two of you on Franklin Street.
My father never minced words, shall we say.
Well, I can't believe, listen, but tell me this. Tell me this. Now, you talked about a clash of egos. I think you can understand coming home, seeing a shop opened up across the street with your money.
But it's not like I didn't try. I just pushed it over the line. But, you know, I had the ball teed up, and as soon as he turned his back, I swang and hit it down the fairway.
You know, it is his building, and it was his money. Why didn't he just throw you out, do you think?
My mother. It's the only my father and I had a very close relationship. We loved each other, you know, really so intently. But he had a temper, and Mom was always the one. You can ask all the guys that worked their way through school working in the store. If it wasn't, they all said, you know, if it wasn't for Mom, they wouldn't have been there because he would curse them out. At any rate, it was not in retrospect a cricket way to play for me to do that. But what I learned, I mean, I emulated him. You know, I had a small foundation for aesthetic development for kids for 25 years, trying to figure out ways to teach creativity to kids. And the oversimplification of how to teach creativity to kids, which, by the way, is the same formula for teaching it to adults, but kids listen. they haven't bought their first wardrobe or furnished their first dwelling with money they made themselves, which makes you defend it for the rest of your life.
I see.
In part. But is the oversimplification is what I call E squared, which is exposure times empowerment. That to foster creativity in someone, you expose them to ways of thinking and the fact that, you know, nothing in this studio that we're in here right now, nothing has to look exactly the way it does. Every single thing can be different, including the ceiling, the lights, the chair, the floors, what you're wearing, what I'm wearing. Every single thing is potentially it could be changed to something else. But most people lack the empowerment. And the empowerment is what gives you enough self-confidence to go and try something that no one else has done. And, you know, my sweet mama empowered me to the extent that my wife, Megan, rues the day because I can see out there agreeing there, Meg, because I think I can do anything.
Yeah, but you did, at least when it came to this. So you'll acknowledge probably not the right way to do it at the age of 21. But tell us how it worked out. I mean, now you've got this store. You're bringing in a different style of fashion, one that was not the American style.
Proving that there was a hunger for a different style, proving that this merger that I predicted between classic American, traditional, and European style was moving towards a merger in the world. And, my father, every vacation that I ever spent with my parents from the time I can remember was always a factory somewhere on the vacation, whether it was a sweater factory in Scotland or a shoe factory in Italy or in Massachusetts or wherever it was. And listening to my father redesign or design things for his store so he had something special and exclusive and different, because he had those seven competitors across the street, one down the street and six across
and
the
street. And now a son. To give us a sense of how he tolerated this, perhaps with your mother's intervention, I guess there's a story you tell about his recognizing there was some appetite for this kind of clothing. They would come to his store, and if they were looking...
He would it was an ego thing. Yeah. He wouldn't carry it, what I was doing in his store, but he would send his best customers to my store to shop and then call over and have the merchandise brought back to his store knowing that I would give it to him at my cost, and then he would make the sale.
But it had to be in your store. What was the difference? Give us a sense of what's the difference in these two styles.
Well, you know, I would say that Dad in those days was the sort of Oxford cloth button-down reptie, three-button sack, narrow lapel.
That's the American kind of
all look. Very classic, but the highest quality.
Right.
And I was doing the highest quality, but you know, shirts were made in Sweden, and they had a fitted body to them. The fabrics had more color to them. The suits were handmade in Copenhagen, working sleeve buttons. You know, I had an underground guy. This was the '60s. I had an underground draft dodger who was custom studying jeans for me. You know, we had all these great new washes and jeans, and we had a couple of co-eds at Duke who I had met that were doing custom embroidered elbow patches for you. And I mean, it was a very cool store. We played, you know, had a 4-inch shag carpet and purple, orange, and lime green that had to be raked every morning, and we played Billie Holiday and Bobby Short.
There you go. Well, so that part, just ahead of that, you had me with memories of the '70s that I couldn't tolerate. But thanks for that. I bailed out. '74, though, obviously, you remember the gas shortages and all of that, which actually hurt your business.
It killed it. I mean, it literally killed it. There was 85% of our customers were from at least 30 miles away, and no one could get there when the gas shortage had happened. But fortunately for me, in an effort several years earlier to build quantity so I could have more creativity with doing special things for my store, because that's what my father did, so that's what I did. You know, it seemed like a normal thing to me. That's what dads did, design product. And so in order to build quantity to increase my options, I would show twice a year at the New York market a coterie of friends who were non-competitive retailers around the country what I was doing and try to get them to buy into it. Not for profit, not with my name on it. Let them do it. All I was trying to do is get cool stuff from my store.
But you were designing this.
I was designing. Okay. Yes. And my, you know, the stuff sold in those stores. So that gave me a kind of built-in leg up later. I was asked by a traveling road salesman from the Northeast who settled in Chapel Hill. He had sold a manufacturer in Baltimore, a suit maker, on the idea that Ralph Lauren was the new kid on the block in menswear, and very few people had ever heard of him, he or Polo in those days. And Julian's was the first store to carry it in the Southeast. I was the buyer, and he had convinced this suit manufacturer that he could design a line that would compete with Ralph. And then he came to me and he said, "Alex, you know, I think I'm too good a salesman. I sold this guy and now I don't know how to do it. But, you know more about this than anybody. Can you help me?" And so I ended up ghosting my first line without my name on it. And that sold. So segue, I think it was 73. One of the members of that group of non-competitive retailers that I was trying to get to buy my work, buy into the same stuff I was doing, was a guy named Bob Pollock, who has the great store in Nantucket now. And he came along with me to the mill representative for one of the Scottish sweater mills. And I did something like 124 sweaters that day. And he sort of sat there with his mouth open, and walking up Madison Avenue at 5:30, we were on the west side of the street. I remember it very clearly. And he says, "You know, I think that's your forte." I said, "What?" He said, "Design." He said, "Forget the retail." He said, "You ought to concentrate on that." I said, "Nah, come on, man. I'm a retailer. You know, this is what I do. This is my blood." And then when the going got tough, I got going.
He did indeed. Alexander Julian developed his own line, many, many lines, and we'll find out about that transition and how he became a successful designer whose name is well known in fashion circles when my conversation with Alexander Julian continues on The State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with designer Alexander Julian today, a member of the Fashion Hall of Fame, known, of course, for creating the iconic uniforms for Tar Heel sports teams, and born and raised right here in the Triangle in North Carolina. Tell us about this now. Now, this transition, you protest, I'm not a designer, but you are. And so tell us about your first line that really took off.
Well, I was sort of forced to think of something to do because that business was crumbling with the gasoline shortage.
The retail business.
Yeah, the retail business was. And I decided to make a stab for it. And I went to New York and went to the top manufacturer of men's tailored garments and had a factory in Philadelphia. And I said, look, I sold myself. Like my friend had done before, except I knew what to do. And I said, look, your risk is a few thousand dollars to make samples. Give me an add-on of 15% if it sells. And it sold. And I, it was radically different. It was exactly what I had envisioned for years, which was the personification of this merger of classic American traditional with a European sense, a worldwide sense of fashion, and that was embodied mostly with my fabric designs.
And is this colors by Alexander Julian?
No, this was under just Alexander Julian.
Okay.
And I first did it under the name Downing Street Collection, and Bloomingdale's quote unquote discovered me after I chased them down. And it's like marrying a woman, you know, you chase her until she catches you. But in this case, I caught them, and they said, no, we want your name up on the wall on 59th Street. They were the hot men's store in New York in those days. And we wanted to be Alexander Julian. And I said, well, sure. And then they called the next morning and they said, we think that sounds too expensive. What about Alex Julian? And I said, no. I'm going with, because I'm named after my grandfather and I have no middle name. So it really is my full name, and I thought would honor him as well. And it took off. I was on top of the world. I got nominated my first year in New York for a Cody Award, the Academy Awards of Fashion. Mm-hmm. Then and won my second year, got two more, was Hall of Fame when I was 33, not 33 years ago, but when I was there, I wish it was 33 years ago. It was a rocket ship, except a rocket ship with no fuel because I was not making any money. I had publicity. Everything I was doing was the finest, the best, because that's what my father purveyed and taught me. And there wasn't that big enough a market for this new look that was this merger, because the American traditional stores would say, you know, I like the fabrics, but that's a little too hip. And the European stores would say, I like the fabric, but that's a little too traditional. Okay. And thank goodness a Japanese retailer, Takakyu, came along in 76, and I showed them, and they got it immediately. And I was successful in Japan before I was United States. And that money kept me going until my father introduced me to a big manufacturer and started the ball rolling on what became known as Colors by Alexander Julian. The advertising agency wanted to call it Selkirk Collection based on the village in Scotland where my mother's family immigrated from. And I spent the weekend just free associating about what people liked about my work. You know, that's an unusual color, Alex, or I like the way you put those colors together, Alex, or, you know, those are nice colors, you know, and so I stepped out and then spelled it with a U because that nasty little man, Edward VIII, the former Prince of Wales who advocated for Wallace Simpson, was the greatest fashion influence on menswear in the 20th and so far in the 21st century still. And so I wanted to give it a British spelling to it, and I took the label design from my favorite Tweed Mill, where I really learned all about spinning yarn and weaving, was in Brora, Scotland, and in Sutherland. And that's where the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders Regiment was. And the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders regimental stripe is what I used for the graphic for the first colors label.
But tell us how you make this transition, because, again, the retailers are telling you it's either too hip or not hip enough.
Well,
What
happened? I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you. Your own show, but you know, I think I know where you're going. And the from the time that I started beating my gums to get this point across to these stores, and the success in Japan allowed me. I didn't have to sell as much. I didn't have to make that nut here in the U.S. And during that four or five year period, the market finally adjusted and the appetite grew into, you know, a famine of people wanting this look of traditional, hip traditional with touches of color. And so when Dad introduced me to this guy who wanted to buy my name, I said, name's not for sale. Ideas are for sale. And I put my name on the ideas only for the purpose of identification.
Well, one of the ways you did this, and again, getting back to your appreciation of the fabric itself, getting right down to the core, was sort of weaving in subtle colors, subtle lines of color into the fabric, right?
You know, I know you don't want me to do this, but I'm going to jump to the future. And if you go online to my Alexander Julian Inc. website, there is a TEDx talk that I did at UNC that will explain my revelation in finding out that, you know, what was my father's passion, which were heathered, multicolored fabrics and yarns that was passed down to me, the love of those, that, you know, 78 was the first time I actually knowingly tried to copy the colors of a painting. It was a Monet painting in the Jeu de Paume in Paris, just before going up to that mill in Scotland to try to spin a yarn that looked like that 50-color section of Limoges, one of these haystack paintings that Monet did. But it was only 15 years ago, after I got Color Marketing's award, and a color scientist explained that, you know, they had a new way of a computer program that would count colors in nature. And an oak tree in full foliage at noon on a clear day is over 300,000 colors. You look at a lawn of grass and you say, isn't that pretty, that green? You know, you're looking at over 100,000 colors. And so, bingo, what I realized is Monet understood hundreds of years before me, my father was attracted to, and I in turn attracted to, was the colors of nature and the complexity of color in nature. And that's what I've spent my whole life, both in fashion and in home furnishings, trying to bring that indoors.
That actually does bring us to the uniform design, because color, the way the color mapped on the eye in television was a little bit of part of the...
Well, that was with the Tar Heels uniform for sure, but you know the first uniforms I did were the Hornets, and you know, teal and purple were considered my house colors. Those were the, you know, I remember my kids when they were little used to think that if anybody sold anything in teal or purple that I got a commission. I wish that was true, but they were colors that were from outside of the norm that I introduced that became popular. And I introduced them because they're easy to work with and they look good on almost every skin tone. Very simple. And they became my signature colors. So when George Shen asked me to do the Hornets, I said, George, you know, you're going to have to work with my colors. And this is a whole long story about how they had wanted to use pink in the uniform, and another show.
Okay, but you did it.
But then to have those be as successful as they were, and enough to get the attention of everybody's hero, Coach Dean Smith, and you know, to have Coach Smith call me, who I'd known since I was a kid, but. You know, I mean, the man was a god on earth, and to have him call me, and I was at Claridge's in London, and that bring bring, and pick it up, and it's Dean Smith, and you know, I described it a million times, but it's the way I felt. It was like having God on the phone, asking you to design new halos for the Archangels. I mean, our team, man. And I want to say very clearly, Frank, we just celebrated the 25th anniversary of the Argyles, which is now the icon for all Carolina sports. And, you know, I'm proud of that. But really, I put the ball on the court when it comes to the Argyles. But it was Coach Smith, Coach Guthridge, Coach Williams, their assistants, the hardworking coaches and staff, and all of those great players. And they're the ones that popularized the Argyle. You know, as I told the New York Times 2 years ago when we did a story on us having Argyle on the football uniforms, which has also gotten great applause, I'm just lucky. You know, our basketball stars made it cool, made it popular, and then we put it on the football team the same year we went 12-2. Had we been 2-12, right, they would have blamed me.
Right. Takes us back to Charlotte.
Take those Argyles off of them.
Well, yeah, and in fact, I think Sports Illustrated put Argyle, bordered their pages.
One of my prize possessions, yeah. Coach Smith, we won the national championship the next year, and he wrote in magic marker on there under his picture of him cutting the net with the Argyle down the side. He says, "Alex, look what you started."
Tell us about this, the business, though, about the uniforms themselves, the sort of powder blue and Carolina
the blue. You know, when Coach Smith asked me to redo the uniforms, you know, and if I wish somebody would show the uniforms the year before I changed them next to the ones that we did. Because it was not a subtle change. I mean, they were micro shorts, and I made they were 3 inches above the knee, but they were considered long and baggy. Mm. They were pleated. The fit of the shirt was the top was different. Did the V-neck because Coach Smith had done V-necks initially and wanted to honor his treatment of that. But the color had migrated. Because of primitive television reception, Carolina blue looked gray on most TV sets and in those days, and so they had pushed the color into a much deeper and much stronger blue. They had pushed it towards Durham, and it was a good color, but it showed like Carolina blue on TV then. But it wasn't Carolina blue. And so I went back to the traditional Carolina blue.
But it's able to print, too, because of the way you sort of layered the colors. So when I say print, you could see it on TV as blue, not gray.
That's really only because of the technology got better.
Tell us about your family now, because they're working in the business. Your son is working with you.
My son, Houston, graduated. I have four Carolina graduates amongst the seven. Houston graduated 2 years ago and came to me in, of course, environmental science, which is perfect for the fashion business. It actually is, because we want to be environmentally conscious in everything we do. But came to me with the idea of doing starting social media to bring back my 80s upper end label. I got killed in 95 in a venture capital train wreck. I went from being a huge, I won't say the numbers, but they're staggering, international business to almost nothing. But fortunately, we had started in fall of 94, our first furniture line that my wife and I designed, and that carried us through. But I never really got the top-end menswear line back. And Houston had the idea 2 years ago, and we've had a terrific success with it.
I want to talk to you, and I haven't
designed in Chapel Hill.
Designed in Chapel Hill. You've got the business set up there
and
now.
Some of it's made there. Some of it, I mean, this knit shirt I'm wearing is made in Morganton, North Carolina. We make our sweaters in Conover, North Carolina. We make our ties in Mount Airy, North Carolina, handmade. And we're even exporting those to our Japanese friends this fall.
So it's coming,
made in North Carolina.
Coming back home. I've left you precious little time, but I do want you to talk about your children, Martha and Chris, because I know you talk about this.
Well, I'm very proud of Martha and Chris. I spoke with her this morning. She's in Brazil. I spoke to Chris yesterday. He's in Asheville. They are love children of my impetuous youth. I was 17 when Martha was born and 19 when Chris was born. And they had the good fortune of being adopted by incredible parents, Briggs and Glenda Leonard in Lexington, and Libby and Penny Book in Winston-Salem. And I got to meet Chris and all the family. I had dinner with my grandson Saturday night from Chris 10 years ago, and Martha just about 4 years ago. And thanks to my wife, Megan, and my kids, it's been a seamless embracement that I became, for the last 3 years, one of the spokespeople for the Children's Home Society of North Carolina. And
which does what?
Well, they do an incredible work of helping kids, babies who need adoption, find homes, and kids who, even up and through their teens, that need adoption, find homes, as well as connect. They connect all the dots in that.
And your involvement comes as you began thinking about how, you know.
Well, if it wasn't for their good works, yeah. You know, Chris and Martha wouldn't have been so lucky. And I am the first biological parent to be a spokesperson for them in 120 years. And I just think it's time to get rid of the bad thoughts and think about love.
I will leave it right there. Alexander Julian, what a pleasure talking with you so much. Alexander Julian, acclaimed designer known for his Colors by Alexander Julian line and, of course, the iconic Blue Argyle redesign of the UNC Chapel Hill sports uniforms. What a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Go Heels.
You can see Alex and his work at Julian's Clothing Store on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. Of course, we got links at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.